Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. I'm Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy, and I'll be your host today, filling in for your regular host, my captain, Frank Gaffney. Joining me in this first segment is a good friend of Secure Freedom Radio. He's a Forbes columnist and a Daily Beast contributor, and one of the foremost experts in my mind when it comes to China and the Korean Peninsula. He is Gordon Chang. Gordon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kyle.
I wanted to talk to you about recent moves on the Korean Peninsula. We had the North Koreans essentially declaring that they were going to abrogate the Korean War armistice and taking another series of what appeared to be very drastic actions and bombastic statements. What is in their mind right now, do you think?
Yeah. Ri Yong-ho, the foreign minister of North Korea, made a striking statement at the end of the UN General Assembly meeting at an impromptu press conference. He said that because President Trump had declared war on North Korea, North Korea had the right to shoot down American planes in international airspace. And that's an abrogation of the armistice, because he said that North Korea had the right to use force. And, you know, the armistice says neither side may use force. So we're back into one of these other situations where the North Koreans have renounced the armistice. And this is a follow-on from at least three times last decade when they have done so in actually clearer terms than they did last month. I don't know what the North Koreans are thinking right now, clearly because renouncing the armistice is really in our favor. And that means that we can do things that the UN Security Council has denied to us. So, for instance, in Resolution 2371, which was adopted last month, the United States did not get what it wanted, which was the right to board North Korean or North Korean-affiliated ships on the high seas to search for weapons. Well, if there's no armistice, there's no agreement not to use force. If there's no agreement not to use force, we can sink North Korean ships. If we can sink North Korean ships, we certainly have the right to board them. And what we need to do right now is unnerve Kim Jong-un. And he is, in one way, which I think is good news for us, has given us the authority to do things that we need to do to keep the peace.
Why would the boarding of North Korean ships be advantageous to us when it comes to, as you said, unnerving the North Korean leadership?
Well, first of all, right now, President Trump, and this is to his great credit, one of the things that he's done right on North Korea is to constrict the flow of money into North Korean coffers. And North Korea earns a lot from weapon sales. And the weapon sales that we are most concerned about are missiles to Iran, chemical weapons to Syria, and of course, nuclear weapons technology, primarily to the Iranians. If we are able to stop that trade, we can further interdict the flow of money into North Korea. We do that, Kim Jong-un doesn't have money for nukes, he doesn't have money for missiles, and he doesn't have money for something which may be even more important to regime stability, and that is gift politics. Kim Jong-un uses money to buy Mercedes, luxury cars, all sorts of things to keep regime members loyal to him. And that's important for stability because the North Korean regime, it's a one-man system. It is unstable. It's composed of a lot of competing elements. He needs to keep everybody happy. The way he does that is just to shower them with luxuries. So we need to prevent him from getting the money in order to buy the luxuries to preserve his regime.
So what is the likely reaction by the North Koreans if we should choose to board ships looking for weapons, either nuclear material or chemical weapons material or just regular conventional weapons that are headed for the black market? What is their likely reaction? A lot of commentators seem to take the opinion that the North Koreans are not rational actors and that any escalation on our part will automatically result in an escalation on their part. Is that necessarily true?
Yeah, we don't know how the North Koreans would react to something like this. This is not a major provocation, such as striking Yongbin, where they have their nuclear weapons facilities, or their various missile sites. This is a much lower level provocation in their mind. And yes, they will huff and puff, and they will try to escalate. But this is a trade that we have to stop, because we cannot permit the North Koreans to sell this stuff around the world. You know, we could say, and we could take a view, look, we'll be happy to let them sell rocket-propelled grenades, like what they are selling to the Egyptians. I don't think that that's right, but nonetheless, people can say that. But we cannot allow them to sell ballistic missiles, because those threaten Israel. We cannot allow them to sell chemical weapons or nuclear weapons technology. I am not happy with Hezbollah, who is a North Korean's weapons customer. I'm not happy with them actually having the bomb. So we have got to prevent this. And yes, this is risky. But on the other hand, we have got ourselves, through decades of relentlessly bad policy, we have got ourselves into a position where every option going forward is exceedingly dangerous. This is something that we have to do. It's unfortunate we got here. We can, if we wanted to, we could have a three-hour conversation on who's to blame, but everyone deserves blame who has handled North Korean policy for the last 30 years. We don't need to do that. What we need to do is figure out how to go forward and actually stop the regime short of World War III. We can do it, but we're going to have to be able to, we're going to have to take risks that we don't want to, but that's because we've had such bad policy in the past.
Well, you mentioned, obviously, the outcome nobody is looking for, which is that overt military conflict over North Korea. But we are seeing the movement of assets, including strategic assets, to the North Korean peninsula. Can you tell me a little bit about what that portends?
Yes. South Korea's security officials have been talking in recent days that the United States has agreed in writing to move, quote-unquote, strategic assets to near the Korean Peninsula. And apparently that is, in fact, true. Though we don't know what that term means in this particular case, but in general, strategic assets means nuclear weapons. So this does seem to be a significant development. You know, it could very well mean that we'll have, you know, more Ohio-class subs off the Korean Peninsula, though that's not really necessary given the range of our missiles. But clearly the South Koreans are concerned about the situation. They want to have, they have been agitating for this for a long time. They are concerned that the United States is not going to defend them. There are many in the South Korean political establishment who want them to develop, who want South Korea to develop its own deterrent. So we need to reassure a very, very nervous ally. And it's not just the South Koreans. The Japanese indeed also are concerned, though perhaps not as concerned as the South Koreans. But nonetheless, the United States needs to go and reassure our friends and allies and partners in the region that we will be there to prevent the worst outcomes.
Well, in addition, of course, to the North Koreans, the Chinese, I'm certain, would be watching movements of strategic assets like this and taking them extremely seriously. This is obviously an outcome that they wouldn't be looking for. Is this something that could possibly encourage them to give us the assistance that we haven't gotten from them so far?
Yes, the Chinese will be extremely upset. We know that because they're upset about the deployment of a THAAD battery in South Korea, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. They believe that that battery can not only defend against North Korean missiles, they think it's primarily there to look into China to degrade their deterrent. I don't know if that's true. I tend to suspect that it is, that the Chinese position is correct, and that our reassurances probably are not correct. But the way that I would put this if I were in the administration is to say to the Chinese openly and in public, look, your support of North Korea has costs. This is one of them. And we are going to increase those costs until you stop supporting North Korea. Because it's outrageous that Beijing is telling South Korea and indeed the United States that we can't defend ourselves against the threat that they helped create. because North Korea's missile program is dependent on Chinese equipment, and almost certainly it's dependent on Chinese technology. So at this point, we need to have some candid conversations with Beijing. And it's not just in private. That hasn't worked. We need to have these in public so that people around the world know what's going on, and so that the Chinese understand that we're not afraid of them.
Gordon, enlightening as always. Thank you very much. Coming up next on Secure Freedom Radio, we'll be talking to senior editor of the Conservative Review, Daniel Horowitz. So stay tuned here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney. Joining me now, the senior editor at the Conservative Review and the author of Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. He's a friend of Secure Freedom Radio, and we're pleased to have him once again, Daniel Horowitz. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be in with you, filling in for those big shoes.
It's a tough road to hoe, but I do my best.
Well, we all do. We all stand in awe, Frank.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the ongoing situation in Iraq right now. For those of you who have been following it, you know, of course, that the Kurdish regional government held a popular referendum where they overwhelmingly voted to move towards independence. And as a result, the Iraqi central government, as well as many of their neighbors, have taken a number of quite militant steps to try to block those efforts. Daniel, tell me where we stand right now.
Sure. I mean, this is pretty unbelievable if you think about it. We've been trying to remake the Middle East for decades, and everything we touch, we make worse. And then finally, when you have an area of the Middle East, northern Iraq, where you have, you know, as pro-Western as they kind of get in the non-Israel Middle East world, that's trying to make an independent state where out of an area where there really is no Iraq left anyway, we won't take yes for an answer. So as you mentioned, you have really a three-way war budding against the Kurds. You got Erdogan's Turkey, who's threatening to attack them in the middle of the night, threatening to choke them off. You got Iran amassing forces because they're worried they have a Kurdish minority, and they certainly don't want them getting any ideas of independence. And then you have the Baghdadi government, the central government in Iraq, again, and I say Iraq very loosely, which is pretty closely aligned with Iran. They're conducting military exercises. They're really collaborating together, all against the Kurds. That Baghdadi government has now shut off flights to Erbil.
It's definitely a tough situation.
No, absolutely. And obviously the Baghdadi government, which we are supporting, is very closely aligned with Iran. They're saber-rattling against the Kurds. And what's shocking is that the State Department is condemning the Kurdish vote of sovereignty. I mean, this is a democratic vote. They voted overwhelmingly in favor of independence. The notion that we would basically side with the Baghdadi government, which is really, I mean, very closely tied to Soleimani and the IRGC, Iran and Erdogan against the Kurds is amazing. I mean, this is all part of the dyslexic foreign policy that Frank and I have talked about for years. And unfortunately, it's really continued throughout this administration. Donald Trump claims to dislike Iran. I think he genuinely does. But I think it's also lost on him some of the policy nuances that the State Department is continuing to side with Iran in these theaters. And what's amazing is you look at all the investments we've made. We're trying to prop up this Baghdadi government. We're trying to prop up Kabul. And, you know, the inspector general recently said we wasted $70 billion there. Here, you could actually have a semi-stable, as stable as they come in the area, pro-Western government that supports us, that's a hedge against all of our enemies there. And it doesn't really cost us much except for, you know, using just the various aspects of statecraft to give them hope, to give them that important backing from America, a little bit of aid that the Baghdad government is now holding up. So what we're really doing is 180 degrees backwards. We're supporting our enemies and not supporting a potential ally.
You know, one of the explanations we have heard from the State Department officials on this has been to claim that the most important thing right now is defeating the Islamic State, and anything that interferes with that is a problem. Of course, the reality is that as Islamic State is on the run, the rise of Iran is the new strategic challenge. Actually, it's always been the ultimate strategic challenge, but they're not preparing to deal with that. What is the plan right now from the Trump administration in terms of how they want to deal with Iran strategically in the region?
You know, that's a really good point. They're speaking about a reality that no longer exists. Look, to the extent ISIS is a problem, it always was more of a problem in terms of their ability to evangelize the diaspora of Muslims in Western countries. And to be quite blunt about that, that's not a military problem. I mean, that's a homeland security problem. It's an immigration problem. The FBI is the front lines on that. I mean, certainly I you know, my view is we shouldn't be bringing in, more individuals in large numbers from the Middle East. But whatever you think about homeland security, in terms of the Middle East, the caliphate is collapsing. They have very little ground left. So right now, the pendulum has swung all the way to the Iranian hegemony. Iran and Hezbollah have a corridor all the way from Tehran to the Mediterranean now. They're taking over. I mean, so to sit and wave a flag about ISIS now is a joke. And number two, you know what's really insulting there? The most effective fighting force against ISIS, and that happens to also be the hedge against Iran, are the Kurds, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and we're not allowing them to hold this ground. And here's the problem. The ground that's being taken from ISIS, it's not really ISIS. It's the Sunni lands. And sadly, ISIS is just a reflection of the endless insurgency. You had Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you had ISIS. Guess what? As a rubber band effect to fight back against the Iranian hegemony, you're going to have the next iteration of it. So, I mean, at least having the Kurds hold as much area as they can is the best outcome for us, because it's neither the Sunni jihadists nor Iran. But again, like I said, we won't take yes for an answer.
Well, I think that this creates broader problems throughout the Middle East and even internationally in general, because we get the reputation as Americans that we do not support and defend our allies and our proxies. Everybody in the Middle East has proxies. The Iranians have them within the Shia militias, and of course with Hezbollah. Certainly the Sunni Arab governments have proxies as well in Syria and elsewhere. And the only people who don't understand the importance of defending the people that are going to work for you seems to be the Americans. How does that play with our standing internationally, Daniel?
Well, I think, again, you're right. You have to view this in terms of a broader pattern. It's not in a vacuum. Recently, we were cutting off aid, threatening to cut off aid to Sisi's government in Egypt because we didn't like some of his internal policies. And he's the only guy that's actually killing all the terrorists there. He's been fighting the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's exactly right. And to those who might think, you know what, who needs this all? Why should we back anyone? Well, the problem here is we're already neck deep in Iraq and we're backing the wrong side. I mean, that's the problem. And this really comes from one central problem that I think our military leaders just don't want to let go of, this myth that Iraq still exists. Because if you let go of that myth, you'd have to be confronted with a very painful truth that we've lost Baghdad. I mean, they are an ally of Iran now. That is a very sad reality of the outcome of the Iraq war, but it is what it is. There is no country. You either have full chaos where they're all enemies, or at least a part of Iraq that's pro-Western. There's nothing to lose and only to gain from this. But again, we are backing Iranian allies over those who would be much closer allies to us. And just one final note, obviously the Kurds have their issues. They have their internal problems as well. But, you know, grading with a curve in the Middle East, they're much, much better than anyone else. And they're not jihadist by any measure.
That's very true. Daniel, thank you for joining us. We'll be right back here on Secure Freedom Radio.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney, who is away from the captain's chair. Joining me now is the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization during the Bush administration. He's the chairman of Applied Research Associates and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Center. He's also a man we've come to rely on when it comes to talking about missile defense and the nuclear threats that face our country. He is Ambassador Hank Cooper. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
I'm pleased to be with you.
So this situation with North Korea as it currently stands is certainly drawing everyone's eye to the reality of American missile defense. And I think it would benefit our listeners to discuss for a moment what the ground truth is in terms of what we're really capable of. And you had an interesting piece at National Review on this topic. Can you talk to me about where we stand in terms of the ability to shoot down a North Korean ICBM if it should prove necessary?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I just point to lead in. We have some capability and could be a lot better, particularly had they continued the programs during the Clinton years and revived the programs in the Bush 43 years that I had sponsored while I was director of the SDI program in the 91-92 time period, because at that time we were broadly investing in defenses that could be based on the ground and in space and at sea and in the air. And that program was scuttled in 1993 when Secretary of Defense Les Aspin at the time said he was taking the stars out of Star Wars, and he absolutely did. And the focus was then put only on theater defenses and on ground-based defenses for the United States, and not very much interest even then. The programs were revived during Bush years. He got rid of the ABM Treaty, which had been a major obstacle of doing the kind of research and development we ought to do. But regrettably, those programs that were most important during the SDI era were not revived. And so the problem we have today is going back to the future, in a sense, to make the best use we can of the technologies that are available today and to redo some of the some of the mistakes that have been made, most particularly to build space-based defenses. And I'm pleased to say that because people are waking up to the North Korean situation that most of us have recognized for quite some time, and finally, the DIA has come up with about three times the number of nuclear weapons they said before. And as I wrote in one of my articles recently, the intelligence community has not been as accurate, regrettably, as had been the claims of the North Koreans, who have warned us that they had this nuclear capability, that they had ICBMs. And furthermore, one problem that they're still ignoring today, our people are ignoring, the priority they place on executing an EMP attack on the United States, which is an existential threat, in fact. And most of our spokesmen, both from Capitol Hill and from the executive branch, have been ignoring that latter threat. Our missile defenses today, we have, I don't remember, somewhere between 35 and 40 or so interceptors on the ground in Alaska and Vandenberg Air Force in California. Their success rate in test is about 50%, half misses, half hits. Our most effective defense actually is the Aegis Defense, which is deployed around the world in some 35 ships now to grow to 44 under approved programs, and could double that if we fully exploited the Aegis destroyers and cruisers around the world. About half of what we have are in the Pacific and half in the Atlantic. That system, as a legacy of the ABM Treaty, was not given the capabilities that are inherent, which is to shoot down ICBMs as well as theater missiles. Frank Gaffney and I were advocating 15 years ago that we give those systems that capability to help defend people around the East Coast from ships that are based and ported in Norfolk, for example. We've avoided doing that because the legacy of the ABM Treaty lives on. And inherently, the Aegis system can shoot down missiles today on their way up, and many people are writing articles say they can't do that, and they can, and they can shoot missiles, of course, on the way down. But we demonstrated in the 2006 or 8 time period that we could hit missiles in their ascent phase above the atmosphere while they're still going up, and we can hit them after they return from an altitude that's too high for our interceptors to reach going back into the atmosphere.
So given the threats from North Korea to target Guam, and as you said, the risk that their nuclear arsenal may be far greater than we understood, what are steps that the Trump administration, if it chose to, could take today to fix this problem?
There are two things they can do immediately. And in fact, the Missile Defense Agency is already doing one. They recently begun a contract with the General Atomic Organization out in the San Diego area to enable one of their drones, I think it's the Reaper, to carry interceptors that could shoot down ballistic missiles while they're still burning in their boost phase off of their launch pads. And that will take some months to accomplish. Before then, we could use the AMRAAM air-to-air missile that is carried by our Navy and Air Force fighter jets to shoot down aircraft. And the way those systems work, they trace the heated air from the jets and destroy the fighter plane by following it back, the heated air back to its source. Could do the same thing with fighters that are in orbit or on station in over international water, but off the coast of North Korea, to shoot down their ballistic missiles in their boost phase while their rockets are still burning. And that's a capability that's inherent in systems we have today, and I believe should be demonstrated. Beyond that, I believe we should make the Aegis system all it can be by demonstrating its ability to shoot ICBMs on the way up, and also to build a new front end for those interceptors that can go faster by employing the technologies that were available on my watch to build a lightweight kill vehicle. As you probably know, every pound that is delivered as a payload from one of these ballistic missiles requires about 20 pounds of fuel before it. So if you build a lightweight kill vehicle, much lighter weight, not only will that give you a greater capability and less expensive capability, but that capability can be used to increase the velocity of the intercept, and the area of defense goes as the square of that velocity. So that's a development that really should be undertaken immediately, in my judgment. People talk about building a bigger diameter interceptor, but that would require a major infrastructure change on board our ships to have a larger launch tube to launch those interceptors from.
What I think is so striking here is that these are problems that not only are well understood in the missile defense community, but they've been undertaken. I mean, there are solutions almost in hand, so to speak. What's the resistance? Where does it come from?
Well, one path of the resistance was associated with the ABM Treaty. That led to the demise of Ronald Reagan's SDI vision. It began actually on my watch when Democrats in the Congress leaders of the Armed Services Committee, Les Aspin being one of them, fought and curtailed the programs on space and some of these other activities we pursued. When Les Aspin became the Secretary of Defense, he delivered the coup de grace. He killed those programs off. And the technologists who were working on them were dispersed. So, and of course, in the private sector, the business goes where the money is. And so that activity has been dormant for a long time. So a root cause of our dilemma today is associated with the ABM Treaty and its devotion to mutual assured destruction, which I assume your listeners know.
Absolutely. Ambassador, we appreciate you joining us so much today to explain these situations and how we ended up in this difficult and untenable situation. And we hope that they're listening in the Pentagon as well as we move forward to fix these problems. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. Joining me next will be Daniel Greenfield.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler. Joining me now is Daniel Greenfield. He's the Shillman Journalism Fellow at the Freedom Center for Security Policy. He blogs at Sultan Kanish, and he's a contributing fellow at the Family Security Matters website, good friend of Secure Freedom Radio. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Daniel, I wanted to take a moment to talk to you about something that is just dominating the news here in Washington, which is the ever-present threat of Russians, Russian influence operations, Russian media manipulation, Russian hacking. And as it turns out, you've wrote a number of stories about some of the recent evidence coming out that the Russians were actually pretty broadly involved with a number of things that had nothing to do with Donald Trump.
That's entirely correct. Now, obviously, Russian operations, or for that matter, foreign influence operations, are absolutely nothing new in Washington, D.C., and much of the media coverage and much of the political hysteria has pretended that there is something new about it. Social media, the internet, has obviously made it much easier for foreign countries to gain influence within American political circles. Now, what the Russians were doing, what we now know they were doing, and it is not surprising at all, is that they were generally trying to conduct influence operations across the spectrum. So when they came, for example, to the National Anthem protest, they were doing ads for the protest, they were doing it against the protest, and they were doing this across a range of issues. So they had a fake Muslim group set up to push anti-American and anti-Israel messages. They had obviously anti-Muslim groups set up. So they were doing things across the spectrum. Why were they doing this? Not necessarily because they supported the various agendas. Obviously, the Russians don't particularly care much about whether football players stand or sit or kneel or dance around for the national anthem. What the Russians care about is influencing people who care about those things. So in a way, it's much like advertising in general. An ad agency trying to sell you pet food does not care very much about the program that it's buying pet food ads on. What it cares about is influencing the people who are watching the program. In politics, it's a bit more complicated because you have to pretend to care about the particular issue. So when the Russians want to influence people with their own political agenda, they have to do it by camouflaging it in the political agenda that already exists on the left or on the right. So they will get inside by talking about the anthem, for example. But this is really about their agenda. It's not about anything else. So they were buying ads for Jill Stein. They were buying ads for Bernie Sanders. And they were doing this because they were trying to influence people on the left by pushing their agenda on things like Syria and things like Crimea, et cetera, et cetera. So their larger agenda was not whatever they were buying the ads for. It was just getting inside this kind of political tribalism in order to manipulate people.
And I think for those in our audience who are familiar with the history of the Soviets and their efforts at influence operations throughout the Cold War, it was very much the same thing, attempting to influence African Americans, attempting to create regional or, as you said very well, tribal differences. And that, I think, goes more to the problems inherent in the current political system, which are available for the Russians to exploit, than it does some kind of Russian cleverness. Would you agree with that?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And the Russians have had nearly a century of using these same sorts of tactics. Now, back in the day, in the days of the Soviet Union, they were more limited to the left side of the spectrum because they had these ideological comrades that would stand with them, and so they had a free run there. After the fall of the Soviet Union, after the fall of communism, things were not quite as simple and linear because they could no longer very reliably rely on the left. But they made up for that by just going into any extreme. So what they found very convenient is that people on the extremes, on the margins, are more likely to listen to them. People who are invested in various kinds of conspiracy theories, people who are feeling disenfranchised. So that's what they began doing, particularly under Putin. And it's not ideological in the old Soviet sense. It's a kind of non-ideological targeting of partisans with partisan messages. So it's very manipulative. It's, again, very much like advertising. And the long-term goal, obviously, is supporting Soviet agendas, whether in Syria or anywhere else.
Which makes sense from the Russian perspective. But what about the perspective of the sort of the dominant media narrative, which has been that everything that the Russians have done was aimed at getting Donald Trump elected? Does that actually jive with what we know? I don't think it does it?
Well, we know where that narrative comes from. The narrative was assembled by Hillary's top campaign people after her defeat. Now, they had an obvious reason for assembling that narrative, because consider what happened. The Hillary campaign had tanked billions of dollars. It had invested a whole lot of energy from the entire Democratic establishment to get Hillary there. Now, whatever your political perspective is, there was a huge amount of money, a huge amount of political influence that had been destroyed here, and somebody had to take the blame for this. Now, that somebody could be the top Democrats who were responsible for this. Obviously, they did not want to take the blame for this. So the Russian conspiracy was very useful. It was useful for a number of reasons. First, it exempted the top Democrats backing Hillary from blame. It preserved their relationship with donors, with the entire Democrat network, because something completely illegitimate and extraordinary had happened. This was really the message that they've been putting out there. Russian interference was something extraordinary and completely illegitimate. They did not lose a conventional election. And second, obviously, created this kind of impetus to conduct what is essentially a coup by constantly accusing their political opponents of being illegitimately elected and of being traitors. The reality is that the Russians had not so much been trying to elect Trump. Again, they've been buying ads for Bernie Sanders, for Joe Stein. What they've been trying to do was cause chaos in American politics for their own purposes, and the Democrats helped them succeed admirably, because the Russians went from being guys who bought $100,000 worth of Facebook ads to being the supposed kingmakers of American politics. You have everybody in the media insisting that the Russians caused Donald Trump to be president. So it's, as far as the Russians go, this is fantastic.
I think you make a very good point there. And it also benefits the Russians to have a democratic narrative which argues how utterly capable and powerful they are, which then bolsters them internationally, rather than a narrative which says, look, the Russians were meddling about the way they typically do, but it didn't affect our democratic polity, and we successfully had an election the way we always have. So the narrative, it reinforces the Russians rather than undermining them.
Absolutely. It creates this perception of strength, which the Putin regime wants most of all, wants to be seen as very strong, as very powerful, as being able to dominate world politics. And really, back to the Soviet days, this is very much how Russia wanted to be seen. It wanted to be seen as this number two in this conflict with the United States. And you can see that going back to the Khrushchev visit. So they created this narrative in which Russia isn't just number two, it's actually number one, because it can dominate the United States. And the Democrats did this for their own purposes, but the result was to cause a great deal of chaos in American politics and to really give the Russians exactly what they wanted.
I think that's really important, Daniel, and it highlights how vital it is that we as Americans educate ourselves so that we can see through these sort of ploys, whether it's from personal and political agendas, or whether it's from foreign influence.
It is absolutely vital for us to understand propaganda in general, whether it's from the media, whether it's from foreign interests. We do have to understand the subtext behind what we're being told, and that's what a lot of people fail to do. You often see people just repeating talking points without processing them. And what anybody who's trying to manipulate our political system, whether, again, it's from the inside and the outside, depends on that. It depends on people just being willing to parrot back what they hear.
Well, Daniel, we appreciate you unraveling that for us. That's all the time we have here on Secure Freedom Radio. We thank you for joining us, and we will be back again, same time, same channel, here on Secure Freedom Radio. I've been your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.